Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and Century Wealth Management.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Pearson Crutcher.
And I'm Jay Healy. Pearson runs the Society of Entrepreneurs. It's a membership organization founded to promote Memphis entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to business owners.
Jay Healy is the founder and president of Century Wealth Management, an entrepreneurial firm that can serve as your family's CFO. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. We're excited to have this conversation with Hilliard Cruz.
Hilliard Cruz started Shelby Group International, a company that he grew from an 8x8 storage unit into a company that exceeded $250 million in sales.
The success of his business led him to give back significantly to the community over time, including funding the Cruz Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of Memphis. Enjoy our conversation with Hilliard Cruz.
Welcome, Hilliard. Thank you so much for being here today to record our podcast, Entrepreneurial Insights. I'm very excited about this interview. I know it'll be great. Hilliard is the former chairman of Shelby Group International. He can tell us all about those businesses, but also Hilliard is a past master entrepreneur for the Society of Entrepreneurs.
What do you mean past? I'm still am.
You are a master entrepreneur. Okay.
He's still here, okay?
A past recipient of the Master Entrepreneur Award. So we've been able to work together for a long time in the society, and I'm real excited about this interview. So thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. Pleasure.
We're excited to have you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Easy way to start the conversation is just for you to tell us your entrepreneurial journey. Where'd you grow up? How did you get the business started? What motivated you?
I worked in a company that was owned by my dad and two other guys, and they imported some products. It was a small company in Memphis, but I worked there starting my senior year in high school. In fact, they started the company in my senior year in high school. I started in the summer there, working there. So I learned something about imports, but I had a lot of different jobs in that business, and they gave me an opportunity to learn a lot. So I ended up, after about 4 or 5 years, I was in the office doing sales work, purchasing. I did go in the Army for 2 years during that time. But anyway, by the end of about 8 or 9 years, I was doing all the purchasing. I was doing most of the sales management, so I did a lot of even the financing. So I had a really key job in that company. It wasn't a big company. We had probably 40 employees or something like that. That was a good thing to learn about business, and I gained some confidence in my business acumen in that time because I felt like I was doing a really good job. I had an independent spirit, and I wanted to do something on my own. This was looked at as my dad and these other guys' business. I wanted to do something that was my business. So I left and started a glove company. And what we did was we sold gloves to distributors who in turn sold those gloves to the factories. And the reason this was such good timing was 2 years before is OSHA had come out with a mandate that all the companies had to supply their workers with protective equipment, and gloves being one of them. So before that, if a worker wanted gloves, he had to go to the store and buy them. Now, the employer had to furnish them, so it was a different market. So I started importing gloves and selling to those industrial distributors. And as I said, they in turn sold the factories. But it was really tough my first year. I mean, I worked at a truck line at night loading trucks. In fact, I tried to get a job with FedEx. It just started up. It was Federal Express then. But anyway, they had just started up the year before I did. And I tried to get a job over there, and they wouldn't give me a job. And I remember the interview, they said, well, they liked everything about me, but I'd had an office job for 5 years, and there's no way I was going to be able to load trucks, load planes. So I went down the street and got a job loading trucks at considerably less per hour, too. I think it was, I don't remember, I think it was $3 an hour instead of $5 an hour. So right off the bat, I had a night job when I started my company, and my office for the first 6 or 8 months, it was actually the warehouse was the living room of my house. But After about 8 months, I got a mini storage unit, which was about 10 by 20, so much smaller than this room. I started real small. We only had sales the first year of $110,000, and I made $3,000. That was before I didn't take any salaries. We made $3,000, but I really timed it well. At the end of 10 years, we were $30
million. Wow. That's some serious growth.
We grew, I think it was 83% compounded every year. That's not quite doubling, but actually my income did double every year for that 10 years. So my income was pretty good at the end of 10 years too. So it was a great time and because of the OSHA law. But there was another thing that I did is I had experience in the company before of telemarketing. And telemarketing was really pretty new back then. The main people that telemarketed was they call you at home to sell you something. And it wasn't business-to-business telemarketing. And so the company I'd been with, they tried to do some business-to-business telemarketing. When I started my company, I said, well, this works pretty good because there's only me and I can't travel. So I'll do it over the phone for a while or whatever. But it ended up working so well because I had a lower cost of operations. The cost of sales to my competitors was probably 8% because they had to pay up their reps 5%. They had to have a manager oversee them. Then they had to pay travel expense and all that. And with my cost of telephone and not having to go out, I was getting a cost probably 2%. So I had a 6% expense advantage. And even though I was a really small company and I paid more for my product, my 6% I was saving in expenses, just that one expense. I saved some other expenses too because I was tight. But that savings right there enabled me to compete right off the bat. I didn't have any problem competing on price. And as I grew, I developed a really good telemarketing plan and I kept it that way. And most of our sales are still that way now, of course.
So what was the company called originally?
It was Memphis Glove Company. After about 10 years, I changed the name to Shelby Group International because I bought out a little glove company up in Michigan that made some product in the United States. And then I also started another company. Well, I changed the name to Shelby Group because I bought that other company and we set up as a different division. So we had Shelby Group International and I had a Memphis Glove Company and I had a Shelby Specialty Gloves, which was selling gloves to the retail stores through wholesalers. But also, I guess about that time, we'd been real successful, and that's in the business. So I decided I would start a protective clothing business. It started out as rainwear for workers. And I found a little company that was struggling, and I bought them out, and they didn't have much business, but anyway, it just gave me the sources that they developed and their product line. So I started with that. And so I built another business outside of Memphis Glove and Shelby Group International. And that business I built with my brother. Got my brother to come in. What we did, we really cloned everything I was doing in my business there. I mean, in fact, initially, we were on the same computer system. I'd computerized my company. And so we used the same computer systems. And I had developed a really good proprietary software for my business. I mean, that I designed when I computerized it. So we used that in that business. He used the same telemarketing to those, actually to the same customers. We were calling the same customers. And that maybe sounds illogical. Why wouldn't you just sell them two product lines? Well, the thing was, I had the views at that time that the customers, they didn't like phone calls anyway. They wanted you to come see them. And I couldn't keep them on the phone very long. So I said, well, we'll sell them one product. Then I'll have another sale. I'm going to call them again and sell them another product. So that was the logic behind it. And the sales were also specialized in their products more. And it worked real well. Eventually, though, after about 35 years, we combined all the companies.
Because you had several different companies. What else? You had Memphis Glove, and then you had the rainwear.
And then we had crew safety glasses for workers. And then we had Shelby Specialty Gloves, which made gloves. The biggest line was fire gloves, but it was a domestic made product. And it was different because we It was very little U.S. production by that time, but we had a U.S. factory that was making gloves for firemen and for rescue workers and stuff like that. And to my surprise, actually, we'd gotten in that business with that acquisition I'd made, I mentioned earlier. But to my surprise, we were able to make a good profit in that business and maintain that business. It's still going now. And the thing was, all the U.S. manufacturer was going. Somehow or another, we were able to keep this one factory keep going all this time.
So you evolved from distribution to manufacturing, or a combination of both?
Well, that was just in that one business that we had the domestic manufacturing. As far as regular import lines, so we started factories overseas. So we started factories in China, started out in Hong Kong. And so we had a Hong Kong factory, then I moved into China. And we were one of the first people to go into China. I got some stories to tell about that. But anyway, about going into China. But anyway, we were in China real early. I think it was 79 when we went into China. Nixon had only opened it up a couple of years before then.
What level of employment did you get to? I mean, you started as a solo practitioner, kind of, right?
I think we got to about 1,700 is where we're at. But we don't actually have that many now. We were at 1,700, and we had a decline in our employment in China, because what we did is we built our own factory in China. We had about 1,000 or 1,200 workers in this factory. But in the last 10 years, we've actually contracted out a lot of that instead of making it all ourselves. There's a big demand for workers. And also, we had to get the workers. We had to go to many different locations to get them. So it was easier to contract it out.
That's interesting.
I don't know. I've gone on a pretty good bit about that. Does that answer your question?
I think it was great. I think so. You did grow up in Memphis. So, I mean,
oh, yeah.
And you went, because I know that you're kind of partial to those people that you went to high school with. And you went to Easter, is that Harriet?
No, I went to Fraser.
You went to Fraser. That's right. Okay.
Harriet went to, she went
to Humes.
Tech. Yeah, I'm from Fraser and graduated in 1962, Fraser High School.
And then you went to the University of Memphis?
Yep. And right after I got out of the University of Memphis, it actually took me 6 years to get out of the University of Memphis because I was working full time. So as soon as I got out, I had to go in the military for 2 years. I was drafted in the Army and served in Alaska. I didn't go to Vietnam. Everybody else was going to Vietnam. So I was really lucky that I went to a place where it was colder than HELL, but it was still, I didn't get shot at.
That's right.
So when you started the business, what would you say was your initial vision?
First of all, I just wanted to be independent. I wanted to make my own income, and I didn't want to be tied to anybody else. I didn't want to make my own decisions. I mean, I had a really good job where I was. I mean, I was making pretty good money, but it was just, I wanted to be independent. And I would say that I thought at the time I was making $25,000. Okay, that was 1974. So that's not bad money at that time. And I thought with the business, I probably could make $100,000 a year or something like that. And I could do $4 or $5 million or something. It just mushroomed. I hit on something that worked, and I worked hard to keep expanding it. And I put every cent I made back into it, because you need it. I mean, to grow like that, you got to have a lot of capital. So, I mean, another thing about that, I was really good at finance and really good work with the banks, but also handling the finances and the cash flow. Because in that business, you had to buy a product like 6 months before you needed it. So the problem was, I mean, you had to forecast what you were going to sell correctly, or you'd have product coming in that you didn't need. So I was good at that.
What did you major in at the University of Memphis?
Math.
I was going to say, Hilliard can amaze me. We can be sitting in a meeting and we have a list of numbers or something. He can look at it and add it in his mind. It's amazing.
I'm not as fast at it as I used to be. Everything's slowing down a little bit. But my dad had that same ability. I mean, that's where I got it from somehow.
What would you say was one of the biggest challenges in growing the business?
Well, the first year we had a recession, and it was 1974. We entered a recession. We actually were entering it when I started the business. I was going to start the business 6 months earlier, and my dad talked me out of it. And my wife probably talked me out of it a little bit too, mother-in-law too. But anyway, 6 months later, I said, no, guys, I'm sorry. This is what I want to do. That's what I'm going to do. So I did it. Of course, everybody supported me after that. But getting through that recession the first year was a real challenge. Other challenges we had were mostly in the area of probably cash flow, because as I said, we were growing. In the first few years, we were growing more than 100%. We averaged 83, 85 the first 10 years, yeah, percent growth. But in the first few years, we were doubling every year. And just managing the cash flow was very difficult, because I was out purchasing stuff that I didn't have money to pay for, and it was tough. And there was a couple of times that my financing got a little out of whack with all that. They had a couple of slowdowns, and I think it was in the late 80s, I guess it was, somewhere in there. We had a recession, and that caused my inventory to build, and I didn't really have enough money to pay for this. So I did go back to some vendors that had fortunately given me credit. I worked with them. They worked with me to give me a little bit more time, and I made it through. But I was scared to death at that time. But anyway, it worked out fine, and my vendors really were really good to me. They helped me a lot.
Working capital and inventory management can be one of the toughest challenges for really growing businesses.
Well, that and employees. So where did you find your employees besides your brother?
Well, Harriet worked with me for a little bit, helped me on the front end. But she had a full-time job. But after about 2 years, she came to work with me for a year or so. But the first employee I had was probably 3 years, company's 3 years old before I had an employee. And of course, I was doing everything. I would take the orders, and then I'd go pack them up and ship them out and everything. But I hired my best friend, which you're probably not supposed to do, as a salesman, and he's still with the company today. It's been good for both of us. It was really good. I did hire my brother, but I hired a lot of other people before I hired him. So I hired my best friend and my brother, which is probably not the best way to hire people. But all of mine really worked out well.
Did you have any advisors or mentors along the way that helped you?
Only thing I had an advisor, I'd say, on was my accounting. I did all my own books from the very start. And I had said I was a math major at the University of Memphis, but I also minored in business. And so I literally got my accounting book, college accounting book, out and set up my books by going back and reading it, because it had been 4 or 5 years since I had accounting. So I got it, set it up, and I had to call the accountant. He was a friend. He wasn't charging me for this, but I was calling him, asking him several questions several times to help me set up my books. And so he helped me a lot.
That's great.
So in the entrepreneurial journey, you do have to learn skill sets. What were your resources that you tapped into for that?
I'd say that I had a pretty good skill set when I started the company, because first of all, I'd done sales, shipping, purchasing.
To learn by doing.
Yeah, and I'd already managed people. So, I mean, I had a really good skill set when I started the company, and I'd learned it for that previous business.
What would you say was the best decision that you made throughout the growing your business? If you look back and think, that was kind of the best thing I did, what would that be?
It was just the decision to go into business and to do this type of business. I started a safety supply business, telemarketing, and I did that from day one, and I never changed it. It's not like it evolved and that things changed. I mean, the original vision was still, it was humming, still humming today, but I mean, it was just like, I made this decision to do this, and once we got through the first year of its recession, my businesses started just growing like crazy. In fact, even in the second year, we did 300,000. The first year did 110. So, I mean, and all I did was just keep focused. I was very focused on that business. I had some other ideas, and friends had other ideas. And I said, well, no, this is working. It's growing like crazy. I'm making good money. I can't go do something else. Now, at the end of 10 years, I did go open up a couple other businesses. And both of those businesses were with my brothers as partners. So I got both of them into the business. And as I said earlier, we cloned my software and all that stuff and whole system, telemarketing system, everything, to make those businesses successful. And they both were really successful.
Wow, that's really cool.
So if you could go back in time to when you were starting the business and give yourself some advice that you know now, what would it be?
I guess it would be checking out the vendors a little better. And the only reason I say that is I had three or four vendors that I'd found before I went in business, but one of them turned out to be a little bit of a nightmare in that the gloves came in real small sized, and they were men's gloves. They were more medium than they were large. And basically in the industry, most of the gloves you sell are large because companies just use a large size. Everybody wears the same size. At least they did then anyway. So I had to end up selling those to a company down in Texas that sold them in Mexico. So, but it cost me a little bit of money on that, not checking out that vendor well enough.
So I know that there's some new news for you, and I've been reading about the paper that you've recently sold the company. So you want to talk about that a little bit? How did you know that that was what you wanted to do?
I've never wanted to sell the business. I thought about it selling it several times, though. I said I never wanted to sell it. I think we were in business about 12 or 13 years, and I remember talking to Morgan Keegan, which is now a part of Raymond James, but talking to them and about going public and all that stuff, and they came up with what they thought they could get, and I thought, well, it was $6 million, I think. I thought, yeah, man, that's not right, because I was doing well. I was probably making $1 million at that time. No way I'm going to sell this thing for $6 million. I'm making $1 million and it's doubling every year. So it wasn't, maybe not doubling quite so much. It wasn't going that fast then, but that was 12, 13 years. But I did think about it then, but then I put it out of my mind for probably after 30 years, I may start thinking about it a little bit because I was getting a little bit older and, you know, I thought, no, it's going too well. Then I did start investing in some other startup companies and all, and ended up having to let the president of one of them go. And so I served as president of that company for about 6 months. So I had a full-time job there. So my people ran my company pretty much without me. They were very well trained, I mean, because they'd been there a long time and they really knew what they were doing. So then it started making me think about, well, I could sell it or whatever. And I thought, well, I got good people running it. Some people might lose their job if I sell it. So they can run it and I can make good money out of it and have a good income stream out of it. So that's what I did. But eventually, as I got older, I'm just going to be turning 76 next week. And my two children, my son and daughter, don't work in the business. Both of them have worked in the business. But my daughter's a stay-at-home mom. And my son has a real estate business that he's done extremely well in. And in fact, he was working in the company when he graduated from University of Memphis also. And he was planning on working in it for the rest of his life. But when he graduated, I'll never forget, we were on a scuba diving trip and we came back and was on the plane coming back. He says, boy, sure, I'm glad to get out of university and graduate. And I said, well, you may have to go back because I'm not going to hire you like I told you I was. This is what I think we need to do. And he looked at me like I was crazy. But I said, I've got a little bit of real estate business that I started on the side. We've got good management of the company. I think we need to diversify our businesses. So we got everything tied up in Shelby Group International. I monkeyed with the real estate a little bit. I says, why don't you take the real estate, try to build a real estate business? He said, well, okay, that's fine. And so he went back to school and studied real estate a little bit, then started his real estate business. And he took over the little real estate business I had, which wasn't much at all, but he's built a really good real estate business. So I was saying that neither one of them worked in the business. So that I thought, well, what's going to happen? Maybe my grandkids will work in there or something, but I don't know. I just don't know what the future is going to hold. And my management was getting older, and I didn't have really any that I was comfortable with that were coming up to run the company. There's some good people there, but I wasn't close enough to some of those people because I hadn't worked there in 10 years. And so I didn't have the confidence in them. I didn't know them well enough to have the confidence in them.
Every business needs a succession plan. Sometimes that's internal, sometimes it's external. But as the leader of the business, you need to think about what you want through that process. So what were your priorities of finding the acquirer?
As I said, I really pretty much never wanted to sell the business because I just didn't want some of my employees to lose their jobs. I just felt like business has been fantastic. The people that work with me have help me succeed, and I couldn't do that. So I started thinking about it again last year, and I said, well, I guess if I can find a company that will take it over, keep everything intact, and keep all the employees and really make hardly any changes, I guess I would be comfortable with that. So what we did, we went back, and we had companies trying to buy us all the time. But my management team and I studied the companies that were interested in buying us, and we came up with one that we thought would do exactly what we wanted. There was another one or two that probably would, but this one had already demonstrated buying some other businesses that did exactly that. So I said, this company seems like it would really do. So we talked to them, and we asked them what their plans were for the business. And they said, boy, we're going to keep everything intact. We want your people. That's who we're buying. We want your people. And we want your locations, because Memphis is a great distribution center. And so they want everything intact. And I said, what about my accounting? Usually accounting is the first thing to go, because the new company sort of takes over some of that a lot of times. I said, no, we want them too. And I said, okay. So we found somebody that would do what we wanted them to do, and then we just had to negotiate a price, and that was acceptable. So we found it.
How long did that process take from looking to closing?
Well, it was going real quick. We started October of 2019. Maybe it was September, but anyway, about that time. And this company was hot to buy us, and so we said, well, we want a quick close too. So they were going to try to close in early 2020, and they had some delays in their due diligence and all, and ended up about February, this virus thing started coming around, and they got a little bit worried before we knew it. It's a London-based stock exchange company, and they had to put it on hold. So they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't do it now. We'll look at it later. So we thought, the pandemic was there, and everybody's worried about their business, so we didn't go back out for try to find another buyer. I thought we could, but let's say, well, let's just give it a few months to see if we this pandemic could get a clearer picture of what the problem is. And then, so that's what we did. So about in June, I went back to them and said, well, we're fixing to open it up to some other buyers. And they came back and said, okay, I tell you what, we're going to come back, because they already had a few months with the pandemic, and they could see their business was doing fine and everything. So they came back to us, and then we were able to close on September 1st. So when they came back to us in June, it's probably the end of June. So it was less than 60 days when they came back to us that they finished it, because they'd done a lot of due diligence earlier anyway.
So in 2020, regarding the pandemic, did you have to make any significant changes in your business?
No. And actually, since we sold a lot of gloves, they were in need. And we had sterile gloves, we had disposable gloves, that type thing too. That was a big demand for that. It gave us probably another $10 million in sales in just a few months, extra sales. But we had trouble sourcing enough product, because there just wasn't enough product out there for everybody. I mean, so we didn't have to make any changes, and we were actually in a good industry for that. It gave us extra sales. Of course, when the industry slowed down a little bit after that, all the factories slowed down because of the pandemic. Our sales went back down. We probably lost some of that extra sales we got because the factories were shut down now.
Are the factories coming back open now?
Yeah.
So they're all back now?
Our business is pretty good. And I mean, I say our business, not mine anymore, is it?
Oh, that'll always be part of your heart.
What is the name of the parent company?
Bunzl, B-U-N-Z-L, P-L-C or something, I think. It's London-based stock exchange company. They do about several $1 billion in business, and they got a bunch of different businesses that they run. And actually now I think that 2/3 of their business is in the United States. It's an old company.
That's cool. Now, since you've just recently been through the sales process, is there any advice that you would have for somebody that was in your same situation looking at selling their business?
I would think they'd want to do the same thing that I did, is first say, what kind of buyer do you want? And I would think most people would say, I'd like our employees to keep their jobs, and I'd like the city to keep the jobs. So let's do something that we can keep the business in the city, keep the employees their jobs. So we got to go out and find a buyer that way. I mean, we didn't go through a broker or anything. We had so many people contact us over the years. I mean, just like once a month, I'd get something from somebody trying to buy us. I mean, but so we had
good problem to have,
a long list of candidates, but when you get down to it, a lot of the buyers are financial buyers, are not strategic buyers, and they'll buy it, flip it, and sell it again in a few years, and that type thing. So it just wasn't the right type of buyer.
That's great. Yeah, taking care of your employees. It's always been the culture of your business, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think we did a real good job. We never had much turnover. So I guess that's a sign that everybody's happy.
How many people were working in that building out in Collierville?
In the office there? I think there's 200.
So you have that main office and then several warehouses in the city?
The Collierville is the office building. But then the warehouse is in Piperton, Tennessee. It's just outside of Collierville. And it's a big bit. It's a 500,000 square feet. You've probably never seen it.
I've seen it driving down the road. I've never been in it.
Okay. It's a big building, but it was the biggest building in Fayette County for a short period of time. But we built another building out there that I think is bigger than that. My son has, okay? I say we, on that property.
So one question we like to ask everybody in the interview is about the spirit of entrepreneurship and whether you think entrepreneurs are born or can they be taught over time?
I think they can be taught. I mean, I did come from an entrepreneurial background because my dad started a company with these other two guys, and he was the key man in that group, in the three guys. And also, I mean, my brothers and I, we sold everything from tomatoes and spinach on the streets to our neighbors going knocking on door to door. I remember one time I sold, I must have only been about 6 years old, but I sold... You take a facial tissue and you can make a flower out of it, okay? And I went door to door selling those things. And I did sell a few of them. So that was early on. I was only 6 or 7 years old probably at that time.
I love it. Once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur.
Yes. There you go, right.
I think they can be taught, yeah.
Well, I would have been surprised if you had not said that they could be taught, since one of the things that we like to lead into is what people are doing in the community. And the Cruz Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of Memphis is obviously very close to your heart. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was not my idea. It was one of the guys at the university wanted to start a Center for Entrepreneurship. They have been several other universities. It's really popular now, but at that time, Georgia Tech and a few other schools had been real successful with it. And so they wanted to start it. And when they brought the idea to me, I thought, well, shoot, this is a good idea. I'm happy to support. So I think they need $2 million then. So I gave them $1 million and they gave me the naming rights, so I guess, on the building. But they also said, now that you've given us the $1 million, you got to go raise the other $1 million. I didn't know I was going to borrow that. So I had to go out and raise that from my friends and business acquaintances. But anyway, we raised the money and started up. And it was slow to get started and very difficult to operate in a university setting compared to my sole proprietorship, okay? So it went real slow and hard to get off the ground, but we finally got a good manager in that got us open, and we went into a building that was already owned by the University of Memphis, and it took a year to renovate it. And a year to plan it, too, probably. But anyway, we finally got into the building and started operating and started enlightening kids about entrepreneurship and showing them what they needed to do to start a business, what's a business plan, financial models, and all that stuff, and helping with that. We've seen some successes. We had one successful enterprise that came out early on was Synapse. It's a payment processing company. They've since moved to San Francisco, but they've raised, I think they've raised about $10 million. So they expanded greatly. So they're not really, haven't been that profitable yet, but their business is growing like crazy. So we've had some startups that have been, but the main thing that we're doing though is we're teaching them how to think as an entrepreneur, talking to them about their challenges and making sure they've thought their ideas out, making sure they've thought about the financing. And so they teach them a lot of different things and really don't expect these young kids to come up with any, most of them are not going to come up with great ideas. And just like me, it's through my business, through my work, I discovered something that I wanted to do and discovered an idea in my past job. So that's what I did. And I think a lot of people are that way. Kids now, a lot of them are going in IT direction, trying to invent a new app or some kind of IT solution for some problem. But those are also real risky businesses and hard to get started. I mean, it's easier to start a business and it's less risk to start a business that has been done before. In other words, start restaurant or any mom and pop business. It's already been done before. It's a proven concept that it works. You just got to manage it right. Those type businesses are easier and take a lot less risk. They also have probably a lot less reward, too, than if you hit the IT app and it goes over big and you make billions out of it. But the thing is, there's so many of those that don't make it, too. And so I've always encouraged the want-to-be entrepreneurs to think about their experiences in life and see a problem that needs to be solved, and that's how you start your business. Probably not going to come up with the greatest idea while you're at the University of Memphis, because most of what you're around is just the other students and all. So you'll think about stuff like how to do something on campus to help the kids get their education or get their books or something like that. But once you get out, you get a lot more broader.
So it's almost like planting seeds.
Yeah. Your mind will open up. You'll have a lot more things cross your mind that, okay, that might could work.
One of the things that I think is so interesting, and we've discussed before, is that Memphis is known for being an entrepreneurial city. Why do you think that is?
I really don't know. We've had several great entrepreneurs come through here, and I guess maybe that's what it is, because there's a lot of spinoffs. I mean, you take Kimmins Wilson and all the people that worked in there and knew that started their own companies, and you take our company. Unfortunately, we had 5 or 6 spinoffs. So that's the only thing I can think of.
Very interesting. Maybe it's those kids going to the Cruise Center and getting that seed and then seeing other entrepreneurs in the city, and it just makes them take that risk too.
Did Memphis play a critical role in the success of your business?
Yes, I think it did. And we were a distribution business, and we were in sort of the geographical center of the United States. So I was able to get a product out real quick. I would take orders during the day, and I would go to my truck line job at 3:30. But on the way to the truck line job, I would drop the shipments off at a trucking company. A lot of times, drop it off at where I work, at that trucking company I worked for, and they would ship it out, cover the Southeast. So they took about 80% or 90% of that they could take. But the service was so good. I mean, it helped that I took the order the same day and got it out the same day. My competitors, when I started my business, it would take them 2 days to ship an order. I mean, and I got it to my customers quicker. And of course, that's one reason my customers like me. This distribution being good here really helped a lot.
You've given back to the community through the University of Memphis, but in other ways also. Why do you think it's important for people to give back?
Well, I think this city needs a lot of help. That's the reason I'm giving back. I mean, we established our family foundation probably 6 or 8 years ago, and actually a lot of my sale proceeds are from selling my company are going into the foundation. So we're going to greatly expand our charitable giving next year. When you set up a foundation, you have a 501c3, you have to give away at least 5% of your net worth every year. So when I put more money into it, that means you've got to give more away. So I'm more than doubling it this year, probably tripling it, I guess.
That's awesome to hear.
It is.
The city needs a lot of help. It's a great city, but we do have a lot of problems. And the biggest problem in my mind is poverty. And the reason that we have so much poverty is I don't think that we're educating our kids well enough. And we've got to educate them better so they can get jobs and they'll stay out of crime. And that's the solution. But trying to turn education around, well, it's like a battleship, trying to turn a battleship, I guess. I never drove a battleship, but I've heard that.
Well, they don't make very quick turns, yeah. I don't think.
But, you know, so we're investing a lot in education.
I know you do Teach for America.
Yeah, Memphis Teacher Residency, Arise to Read, New Leaders for New Schools. I could go on. There's a bunch of them.
That's a blessing.
What excites you about Memphis these days?
I just love the community. To me, it's a big enough town to have just about everything that you would want, and you get around easy. So I just love the city. There's a lot of good stuff going on. I guess you should ask me what excited me. I mean, there's a lot of building going on and a lot of good things happening. We've got a lot of good organizations that are trying to make a difference in our city. And I think it's gradually changing, and it's going to gradually get better.
That's great. Well, personally, we want to talk about some things. And one of the questions we always like to ask people is, what are three things besides your family that you just couldn't live without? Water skiing.
Well, I can live without water skiing.
You can?
Yes, I can. And I didn't think I could, but last year I quit water skiing. And the reason I quit water skiing is I took up tennis about 6 or 8 years ago. And my water skiing was going down every year because I had already peaked performance. I was getting older, and it just kept going down every year. So I took up this tennis, and it was new to me. I never played before. So naturally, I was getting better every time I played. And I said, wait a minute here. This is fun. I'm getting better every day rather than beating my head up against a wall trying to maintain what I did last year and can't do it. So I skied more than anybody in town. And all my buddies could not believe I was going to give up water skiing. But I says, you just don't understand. I'm going down here every year. And, of course, I'm older than most of the skiers. But I'm at the age where I'm not improving. I keep going down every year. I got this new sport that I go out and I play better. And it makes me smile when I get through instead of cussing. I said, so this is a lot more fun.
That's some good advice.
I do miss it. I mean, I live on 100 acres, and I built a lake out there at my house to water ski on. And it's a little unusual, I guess. But I still fish in the lake, and my buddies still stay at my lake. And I see them out there, and I want to. But the last time I did, I wasn't going to ski last year, and I decided to ski one time. But instead of skiing, I said, well, I might get hurt skiing. I will barefoot. Now, barefooting, to me, was safer than water skiing, okay? But even though you had to go faster and you might think it's worse. Well, anyway, I never get hurt barefooting. I'd only barefoot a few times a year. But anyway, I went out and barefooted and darn if I didn't pull a hamstring. And I said, that's it. I can't do this. And I had to stay out of tennis for a month. And I said, no, I can't do that again. I can't get hurt because I missed my tennis for a month. So anyway, so right now, I guess tennis is about the biggest thing. And I ride bikes. I like to ride a bike, too, just for exercise.
That's great. Very cool. Is there anything that our listeners would be surprised to learn about you?
No, I guess I'm pretty much an open book, I'm sure. No.
Guess I should have asked Harriet that question. She probably would have shared.
Well, I don't know. Some of them probably may not realize it, but maybe people realize it. I don't know that, but I'm pretty tight. Okay, and I always have been. And that's one thing that I would say, I always tell to aspiring entrepreneurs, you better save your money if you're going to start a business. You're going to need it. And if you think you can go out there and raise money from other people, maybe you can, but guess what? They get part of the business. And you don't want to have partners if you can do it yourself. So I've always been real tight and say that. And I live on 100 acres with a big house and a lake and all that. But still, all my life, I've been real tight. I mean, I'm so tight. I still do it today. I use both sides of the paper. This is ridiculous. Something will come in the mail, and I'll read it. And I look on the other side, and I say, oh, there's nothing on the other side of this sheet. So I'll put it on my desk here, and I use it to write on the other side, write notes on instead of throwing it in the garbage. So I am pretty tight. I think I got that from my mom, who only had about $20 a week to raise four boys on, and she was pretty frugal. Still is.
Well, being tight served you well, so that's okay, right?
There's a time when you can spend your money, and there's a time when you can't.
That's exactly right.
Well, we really appreciate this conversation. It's great to hear the story. Great to hear all the details.
I enjoyed it.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for doing this for us.
It's been a fun time. And I can't believe what has happened in the last 47 years. I mean, it blows my mind to think back on it. I mean, when I told you a while ago that first year we did 110,000 and it was about 30 million 10 years later, that's just crazy.
It's crazy. Well, it had to have some good leadership, so I don't think it happens by accident.
I happen to think of the right thing at the right time, and I guess I implemented it pretty well.
That's right. What is Kimmins Wilson said? It was half luck, half brains.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say you only have to do a half day's work. You take the first half or the second, first 12 or the second 12.
That's right. We had a lot of good ones.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Hilliard Cruz.
If you want to find more about Hilliard Cruz, you can find a link to the Society of Entrepreneurs profile in our show notes. Thanks for listening to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to share with your friends or colleagues. You can find more episodes or subscribe anywhere that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And of course, reviews are always welcome and appreciated. You can also check us out online at entrepreneurialinsightspodcast.com or bluffcitybusiness.com.